Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who met his wife while training for the 400 meters in Seattle and is eating gluten-free while lusting after bread, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. And well, my friends, welcome back to our monthly fireside chat with a physician to get to know their journey, their joys, and their struggles with finances, and of course, outside of finances. Now, this show, we talk a lot about actionable content, and today, this is a chance for you to see behind the curtains and to really walk in another person's shoes and experience their lives. Now, our next guest, he is just right down the road, an hour or two away from me here in Minnesota. He is an anesthesiologist, and of course, he has a passion for beer. And before too long, he's just going to have a passion for beer. Just kidding. I think he has a few other things going on too. Anyhow, he has been focusing on financial independence by retiring early. So by day, he is the physician version of a Clark Kent or a Bruce Wayne. But by night and over the internet, you may call him Physician on Fire. And he is on the verge of retiring well before he is 50 years old. So I can't wait to hear about this journey. Please help me welcome Physician on Fire. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, David. That was quite an introduction. And I'm happy to be here. So thank you for the invitation.
So the question is, are you Bruce Wayne or are you Clark Kent?
I am neither, man. I'm just an ordinary, average guy who happens to save a decent amount of money.
There you go. Well, I'd love to tap into your wisdom today, my friend, and your journey, because this podcast, of course, is about empowering doctors with knowledge so they can slash their debt, slash their taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. So before we get into content, before we get into awesome advice, first, just tell us about you for people who may not know you. Where'd you grow up, and what was it like for you growing up?
Well, I grew up right here in Minnesota, and we lived in southern Minnesota, but spent a lot of time in northern Minnesota too, which is where I ended up settling down at this point in my career. My dad was a dentist, and so was his father, and my mother was a nurse. So healthcare was, just kind of part of the family tradition. And my mother's dad was actually a physician as well. Had a great childhood, like I say, with a dentist and a nurse for parents, we lived pretty well. I try to tell people that we didn't necessarily have the silver spoon in our mouths when we were born, and even though we had more than enough money to get by, we still learned to find value, look for deals out there. My parents, kind of like me, they had good jobs. Actually, my mom stayed home for the most part and raised us, but my dad made good money as a dentist, and but he didn't show it. By night he was also an ordinary average guy wearing flannel and using a chainsaw to cut down trees and fixing cars with his buddy who was an auto mechanic. So we spent a lot of time going to garage sales, hitting up every Goodwill and Salvation Army between southern and northern Minnesota. And so while we did have a pretty comfortable upbringing, we also learned to save money and spend wisely.
Mm. So was that, like, with your dad being a dentist, and he was more in kind of the rural areas, so he wasn't so much in like the Twin Cities, is that right?
Right, yeah, we were a good hour away from the Twin Cities.
Was that something where you spent a lot of time with your folks, at the dentist office, at the hospital, was that something kind of ingrained in you from the beginning?
To some extent. We lived a couple miles out of town, out up a big hill, and I remember being about the age my kids are now, and we would bike 2 miles downhill into town in the summertime and goof around all day in town, going to baseball and just playing with our friends, and then meet up at the dental office in the afternoon and hang out until he was done and get a ride home, because biking uphill is not nearly as much fun as biking downhill. And then that's it. Yeah, we spent a lot of time as a family going up north. Like I said, we spent time up in northern Minnesota, where my parents actually had a little lake cabin, which they've now retired to. So good deal of our summers before we were old enough to have jobs were spent together up north, you know, canoeing, camping, cutting wood, like I mentioned earlier, you know, you name it.
So it sounds like, I mean, really for you growing up, and there's a lot of hard work around being part of your family. You weren't just sitting around playing video games all day.
We did some of that too, but yeah, I don't want to say it was hard work, but there were certain expectations, and you know, I mowed the lawn for a long time, my grandparents too, and I was paid some for that. Again, learning the value of work, and yeah, oftentimes on a Saturday morning we'd wake up to the alarm of the chainsaw, and that meant it was time to go out and pull brush and move logs, throw them in the trailer.
Different upbringing. I mean, for me, I think about myself. I grew up in Southern California, you know, nothing but suburban area, right? There was no chainsaws going on.
Right. Yeah, so it's all relative. I mean, I had friends that were farm kids that did 10 or 20 times the amount of manual labor that I did as a kid, you know. But it wasn't a purely Southern California suburban upbringing either. Somewhere in between.
How do you think of that for your kids today? You know, as you look at yourself, I mean, are you having your kids waking them up with the chainsaw sometimes? What does that look like for you?
I'm not as hardcore as my father, but yeah, they're 6 and 8 years old right now, so we're just kind of getting to where they can be a little more handy and useful. Although we've had little chores for them all along, like, you know, learning to clean up their room, and then along, you know, the whole learning about value. We try to teach them from a very young age, like what a dollar is worth, and they have an allowance. They have the spend jar, the save jar, and the give jar. So they learn about giving, and they learn about, like, say they see a pack of Pokemon cards at the grocery store. I want that. Okay, but let's look them up on eBay when we get home. And instead of 8 cards in a pack for $4, you're going to get 100 cards for $5, you know. So, yeah, we're trying to teach them similar ideals. And when they're just a little bit older, yeah, they'll be mowing lawns and probably hauling wood too.
One thing you might be interested in, I was just checking out Smart Passive Income podcast. They had a challenge on there, and mm-hmm. I'm going to do an episode on this with my daughter. She recently broke something in our shower.
Ooh.
And I'm going to have her earn it by an entrepreneurial venture, which basically the idea is you find items on sale through a retail store, and then you do a arbitrage, turn around and sell that through Amazon.
Like the FBA. Yeah, that's good. That's a good idea.
So something to think about. I'm going to try it out, see how it goes.
That's great.
Well, anyhow, as you grew up, so I imagine you're sitting in your dad's office, you know, you're playing with toys, hanging out with buddies. Was that something where it's like you knew you wanted to be a dentist or in medicine? Wear the white coat? What was that like?
I think so. You know, I always did pretty darn well in school academically, and I enjoyed science as much or more than any other, you know, discipline. So it was not a stretch for me to go down that path. I didn't consider dentistry all that strongly. I had an older brother who had tossed around the idea for a little while, so maybe that's why I chose to go a different path. But I thought doctor most of my upbringing. There was a time I can remember, I think it was the 1984 Olympics, when there was a really good men's gymnastics team. And at that time, I thought when I grew up, I'd want to be either a gymnast or a comedian. It's kind of the two. I was trying to decide between the two. And at the times I was mowing lawns professionally, but I ended up doing none of those things. So, but I think that's okay.
Well, you know, I think the comedy really comes across in your blog, though. I still see that influence, you know, in terms of what you're doing. So you've come around full circle, I think, in terms of adding some of that to your...
Well, thank you for that. I do try to keep readers at least somewhat entertained, because, you know, this is a dry topic that we're discussing. And so, yeah, if I can, you know, give you a little chuckle, or at least give myself a chuckle as I'm writing it, because I do have fun just coming up with different ideas and little inside jokes. And if those catch on with the reader, well, that's great.
So here's the question. Is your budget sexy?
No, there's no such thing. I suppose it is sexy to have the confidence that comes from having a budget and then having money set aside. But yeah, I wrote a post that says, no, budgets are not sexy. I tried to get it published as a guest post on Budgets Are Sexy, but apparently people don't like it when you kind of discount the whole premise of their site.
Oh, I loved it. I think everyone should check out that post. We will link to it in the show notes. I was laughing. That was hilarious.
Thank you.
So when you were growing up, you're going through high school. When you applied to be undergrad, did you know at that point that medicine was it? Or were you still twirling around with the gymnastics and comedian idea?
Well, I had kind of given up on the whole pommel horse thing. I did actually do, I think, a year or two at the local college. They had like a kids gymnastics thing, and a few of us that were also in wrestling did gymnastics. It might have been 1 or 2 years, and we never really got very good. So that was done. I briefly entertained the idea of business and like advertising specifically, and I think that's probably about the time that Super Bowl commercials were selling for $1 million for a 30-second segment. I thought, I could work 4 minutes a year and make $8 million, right? So I should maybe I'll do that. But I realized that wasn't really going to happen either. So yeah, I by the time I started college, I was pre-med all the way.
And from your blog posts and stuff, I think you tell a little bit more about this journey. You got some scholarships getting into undergrad, right?
I did. I had full tuition for 4 years. There was a Robert C. Byrd scholarship. It was another, I think, $1,500 a year. Quite a few one-time scholarships from various local organizations and endowed scholarships and that sort of thing. So yeah, I also had a bit of money from my grandfather when he passed away. He left money for his 3 grandkids. So I had about $40,000 worth over 6 years of additional help with tuition and everything else. So I finished undergrad in the black, and then it wasn't until medical school that I actually started taking on debt.
As I think about kids and money, I mean, obviously you were intentional about money even at that stage, because a lot of people would have just bought a new car, right? And the money's gone.
Yeah, and I looked at a lot of kind of higher caliber private colleges, and I was accepted some of them, and you know, once I had an offer for a full ride at the University of Minnesota, I thought, those other colleges look good, but hey, this was good enough for my dad and his dad and my mom too, so I think the U would be just fine, and ended up being a really good choice for me.
So what lesson do you take from that as you look at physicians, obviously they're well past that stage, but their kids are working towards that stage. A lot of our listeners, you know, they're 35, 40, they have a couple of kids that are around our kids' age, you know,
right.
1 to 15. What would you say to them in terms of advice of thinking about trying to get their kids in the black, you know, as they look at undergraduate?
Right. Well, yeah, and then when you look at medical school costs, the average debt back when I finished of the indebted student was about $95,000 or $100,000 coming out, and that's double already. That's close to $200,000. As far as education, I think there are probably a few disciplines where the Ivy League education is going to make a big difference, you know, in terms of networking, you know, in finance or Wall Street, or, yeah, I'm sure there are, you know, a handful of disciplines where that's maybe really important, but for 95% or more of us, you know, it's about the education and it's about the person more than anything else. And so you can get a good education at, you know, most flagship public universities and even, you know, a state school for, it depends on what you want to do. But a lot of my med school classmates, they went to, you know, the, not even the flagship state university, but other public universities or small colleges. And I think we put a little too much stock in getting into the best college or having the lowest, you know, student to teacher ratio, or did I have that backwards? Anyway, you know, I was in biology with 500 other kids, and that was just fine with me. You know, depends on the student, but yeah, you can get through college on, you know, $10,000 a year or $50,000 a year, and you do have a fair amount of say in which of those happens, or at least your kid does, and if it's your kid, hopefully you have some say too.
Well, and the thing that I really want to just pound the table on for people is obviously with a price tag of $50,000 a year, even $25,000 a year, I really even wonder, is the price of a college education worth it for some kids? Right? I mean,
the return on investment there, if you're going to the most expensive private college, taking out loans all the way through and not finishing with a degree that translates well into a good paying job, then maybe not. But on the other hand, there certainly are a lot of data to suggest, you know, that college graduates earn more than high school graduates, who earn more than high school dropouts, you know, and then graduate students or those who have finished graduate school earn more. So there is a relationship there, but it depends on, again, the job. There are, as you said, entrepreneurial type jobs that don't require a college education. You know, Mark Zuckerberg found one, did pretty well with it. So did Bill Gates and, you know, a bunch of others. But yeah, no, you're right. And the more you put into that education, the more you're going to need to get out of it to make it a good investment.
Now, take us through the point. You're in medical school now, and you started a residency. So you have a positive net worth at this point, negative net worth. Where are you at this stage in the journey?
After medical school, I had spent all of the money that was given to me by my grandpa when he passed away 20 years earlier. And I think I had about $60,000 in student loan debt at that point.
Which I think many people did. I mean, obviously, college costs have gone up from the time that you've come out, but still, that was relatively a drop in the bucket, wasn't it? You know, to get started on the right foot.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if it wasn't for the money I had, you know, been given by family, I would have had $100,000 in debt, and that was about average at the time. You know, and that's even after going to public school and having all those scholarships and making a lot of good choices, living in crappy apartments in Dinky Town and Seven Corners there, right next to campus. So I didn't have to have a car for most of that time. Anyway, yeah. So I mean, and again, it's now double or more for people that are coming out now. So I do definitely feel for them.
Well, how much do you think at that point, were you like zeroed in on that debt at that point? Or were you kind of like, yeah, I'll take care of it as things go along? How are you thinking about debt, you know, at that stage in your journey?
Well, I knew I was going to have a six-figure career of some kind. I didn't know what specialty I might end up in at the time, but you know, even pediatricians and family practitioners who were at the low end of the pay scale were making at least $100,000 a year. So I wasn't terribly concerned about eliminating that debt as soon as possible. I did end up choosing anesthesia, and I had refinanced those loans down to, I think it was around 2%. It was very, very low. I think it was actually a consolidation through the government student loan program that they used to offer. And so I let that ride, just paying the $300 a month or whatever it was on a 25-year repayment plan. And I did that until just maybe 3 or 4 years ago when I got tired of sending that check out every month and just paid it off with one fell swoop. Because at that point, you know, once I was closing in on maybe a seven-figure net worth, then the 60 grand wasn't so much of a burden, more of a drop in the bucket, as you said.
So it really sounds like the interest rate was super low, about 2%. So you weren't really concerned about that for quite a while, even after you transitioned to practice.
No, I just, you know, and I, of course, in my head, I'm kind of doing the math. Well, the stock market should return maybe, you know, 6 to 8%, and I'm only paying 2% on it. You know, unfortunately, I made too much money to make it, tax deductible interest, which if you make less money than a physician, you can deduct your student loans, make them even more favorable to hang on to. So the math favored keeping those loans as long as possible. But and it's the same thing with mortgage interest, which I've also decided not to carry because, again, I think there's a value in being completely debt-free, even if the numbers might suggest you'll come up with a little bit more money if you keep those loans and invest the difference. I'm very happy to not owe any money to anybody.
So tell us more about that decision. So mathematically, you know, you look at the numbers and you should have not paid it off, it sounds like, but you chose to anyhow. So tell us more about that decision of why you chose to pay it off and why being debt-free was important to you.
Sure. At some point, I just looked at where I was, and maybe I was 35, and I knew about how much we had saved up and how much debt I had, and just made the decision one day to be debt-free by 40. And that's a post of mine, too, debt-free by 40. And I kind of talk about how I realized I just didn't want to have that burden, didn't want to be writing those checks. You know, the student loan checks were only $300 a month. The mortgage was more like $3,000 a month. Mm. I didn't want that going out every month. And I've read a number of threads in the meantime on different forums like Bogleheads and White Coat Investor, where everyone that said they paid off their loans, even though they knew that they probably could have made more money in the stock market and in hindsight would have, they have zero regrets. And they sleep well at night knowing that the house they're sleeping in is 100% their own and that they have already paid back every bit of money they borrowed to get through school. And so I feel the same way. Now, yeah, a few years ago, the stock market went up 35%. It would have been nice to have a huge student loan balance and all the mortgage I could get and have all that money invested. But at the same time, you know, we only know how well the market did 3 years ago in hindsight. So, you know, paying off those debts, it's really like getting a guaranteed return. So if your loans are at 6.8%, like a lot of the federal loans are these days, you know, when you pay that money off, you're getting a guaranteed 6.8, which you can't even get half that guaranteed anywhere else.
That's right. Well, I think that's exactly where I go. And I think what I look at for doctors is it gives them flexibility, I think, in terms of having less obligations, which
right.
I think you kind of
alluded. And then when you get your paycheck, you keep a lot more of it when you're not paying a mortgage and you're not paying your student loans anymore.
Well, and you look at it, if you take money from another pot, right, and you have a really bad year, that really can compound the issue if you still have obligations in the future. So I think you might look at it mathematically on average, that could be true, but in a really bad year, that could be painful.
Right, and the sequence of returns certainly plays a role too. So you never know what you're going to get.
No, absolutely not. So let's say that, let's just time flip on you here, physician on fire. Let's time flip on you. And let's say that you were someone that today had $200,000 in residency at 6.8%. How would you be thinking about that now? So let's play with that scenario. So you are a newly minted resident. How would you be thinking about that 6.8% $200,000 debt?
Well, as a newly minted resident, there's not much you can do to pay it down, right? Because you're making enough money to live an okay, a decent lifestyle, and hopefully make your student loan payments as well. And there are different options of forbearance or maybe deferment, depending on your situation. But what I would be focused on is trying to lower that interest rate. And it's easier to do once you're finished residency. There are more refinancing companies that will take those loans and give you a better rate. I believe there's at least one that will do it in residency. And I want to say that's DRB.
Yep.
But I haven't, since that isn't a huge part of my story, I haven't focused as much as some of the other physician personal finance bloggers on that issue. But I did take all the good posts I can find and put them in one place on my site. So they're linked out too. And that kind of serves as a resource, since I don't have the time or haven't found it yet to really become an expert on the various acronyms and all the different facets of each of the different refinancing companies to really give out like specific information to people that say, well, I have this amount of debt and I'm looking at PSLF, but what if I did this? And it gets very complicated. You need to know a lot about that person's financial picture to really answer some of those questions. But specifically as a starting resident, I would do what I can to refinance, and you can always refinance again. Now, the alternative is if you are looking at potentially, and now this may disappear, but the Public Student Loan Forgiveness Program, PSLF, if you're going to enter that, then you can't do the refinancing. So, you know, if you were going to do a 6 or 7 year residency plus fellowship, and you're working at an eligible institution that's nonprofit as a resident and fellow, then you'd only need 3 or 4 more years working for a nonprofit, which many, many hospitals are technically nonprofit hospitals, in order to get a decent portion of those loans forgiven. Now, again, that's very much in question if that'll even be an option for residents that are starting, say, this summer or next summer. And it's not even guaranteed necessarily for those that are currently in the PSLF program, but most people seem to think it will be grandfathered in, that you'll be able to finish out and have the forgiveness if you've already entered the program. So that remains to be seen.
So in your particular case as an anesthesiologist, do you think if you're in that shoes, knowing you have $200,000 in debt, would you go for public student loan forgiveness, or it sounds like you might be leaning towards just refund? Where would you lean?
In anesthesia, I might not. There are more, I'd say there are a higher percentage of jobs that are not working for a nonprofit in anesthesia compared to, let's say, internal medicine or a number of other specialties. Basically, the more specialized you are, the more likely you are to be in a private practice as opposed to employed. So I do know I'm personally working for a nonprofit, but when I started, I did purely locum tenens work as an independent contractor. So that work would not have qualified me anyway. And then it's only a 4-year residency for anesthesia, so you'd need to do another 6 years in working for a nonprofit to potentially qualify. So that, it's maybe not the best situation.
Well, it's so interesting to think about, and I know there's a lot of doctors I've talked with saying I could go either way, right? They might do private practice, or they might do public nonprofit work. So it's a conundrum, and I guess what I encourage everyone to think about is just crunch the numbers and hedge your bets. I mean, I would often think that if you are going for public student loan forgiveness program, you might want to save a slush fund on the side, more so than some of your peers, just to
exactly make sure. Invest in a taxable account or have some available money that you can use if PSLF does fall apart and not work out for you.
All right, well, let's take pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like some members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you've never received financial training during medical school, and you struggle with enough time to do it all. And well, my friend, about a year ago, I started offering my book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, for only $1 plus shipping. Well, this offer, it's coming to an end. And so only through the end of August, you can still pick up my book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, for only $1. That's right, the whole copy, a physical copy to hold in your hands for only $1 plus shipping. And actually, that's only just part of this incredible deal because I throw in a bonus electronic copy completely for free so you can start reading it immediately. But there's a problem. This is coming to an end. So make sure you take me up on this offer. Are you ready to pick up this book and get the financial training that you've desired? You can visit the podcast website now at www.drfreedombook.com to pick up your copy, or you can simply text Dr. Book to 44222. Don't let this podcast, my friend, be like other ones where you hear great information, you get some new ideas, but you never actually complete anything. To snag your copy now, visit www.drfreedombook.com or text Dr. Book to 44222. What do you think in your life, Physician on Fire, what has been the most important aspect about money to you?
You know, I guess really when I look at money, it's what it can do for me and what it can do for my family. You know, I look at money as, you know, being somewhat equivalent to time now. You know, I used to take a lot of my time and turn it into money. Now that I have money, I'm taking back some of my time. So I'll be working part-time starting this fall, which I think will be wonderful and will give me more time to do things that I want to do and just haven't found the time or made the time to do. And on top of that, you know, I'm in a position where I feel I have all that I need as far as maintaining our current lifestyle, being financially independent, and then a little more. So I think about money in terms of what it can do for other people. You know, $100 or, you know, even $1,000 that, you know, I might donate, well, it maybe doesn't do that much for me. It's a small percentage of what I now have earned and saved up. But it can serve a whole lot of meals at the soup kitchen or, you know, pay someone's electric bill, you know, something like that. So I can use money to do good for others as well. And that is something I haven't had a ton of time to do, a lot of volunteering, but I plan to do more, you know, personal volunteering too once I'm working less or not working at all.
So what fires you up then in terms of that side of it? What kind of things do you want to volunteer in?
Well, one thing I haven't done before, and I certainly could have found a way, I just didn't make it a priority, but is to, before I actually retire, go do some anesthesia work in an impoverished country. So looking into potential options in Central and South America, and I want to do an experience that will allow me to perform anesthesia, but also allow me to take my family, and, you know, they may be helping out an orphanage or doing something different, or just playing with kids and or watching kids so that the parents can go work, you know, during the time that we're there. So that's what I'd like to do. Involving the family, I think, is really important. Showing our kids who are, you know, they're going to grow up kind of like I did, with all the advantages of a sort of a middle to upper middle class upbringing, and so I want them to see a different side of things. So, you know, we've gone to the local soup kitchen a handful of times and help prepare and serve the meal. And there happens to be an old piano in the corner, so the boys would play piano and entertain the guests as they come in. And yeah, so just what else could I do? I don't know. You know, there's a lot of things I can do, but for each hour I work in anesthesia, you know, that hires quite a few people to do other work at an hourly rate much lower than mine. So I've done more with my money than my time, but I'd like to do a little more of both.
So how do you think about, like, going to halftime? Is that something that they definitely want you on? You know, like halftime, do you get any pushback at all saying, well, gosh, we need you here three quarters time? I mean, how have those conversations gone as you've been looking to make this transition?
You know, it went really smoothly. It was really more of a casual conversation that I was having with one of my colleagues. And, you know, I said, yeah, I think whenever, you know, one of our partners is ready to go part-time, you know, I'd be ready to do that too. And he said, yeah, you know, I don't know if you necessarily need one of us to go part-time with you when we hire somebody. You know, we could probably share that responsibility among, you know, two or more. And so at first we were thinking he and one other partner would each pick up 20% extra work, because actually they were already working as locums elsewhere a little bit extra to make additional income. And their hospital said, no, you can't do that anymore. So they were wanting to work more for more money. And I said, well, that'd be great, you know, so I could go to a 0.6 and they would each work a 1.2. And then in talking with the rest of the group, we learned that they all wanted to do a little extra. So each of my four partners will be working an additional 10%, and I will be working 40% less. So it'll be a 0.6 for me. And the way our schedule works out, I'll be able to take off pretty big chunks of time to do, like, for example, we might go to Peru this fall, do a week of anesthesia time, and then also maybe sneak over to Machu Picchu and see some other great historical sites too.
That'll be fantastic travel.
Yeah, I hope it works out.
You're going to have to change to a travel blog and give us...
You know, it'll transition. The blog will grow with me, definitely, and there will be more of that. You know, I'll still talk about the financial implications and how we got to the position of being able to do these things, but But yeah, I'll definitely include, and you know, photography is kind of a passion of mine, so posts that describe what we're doing, where we've been, and how we're using financial independence to create this life will definitely be featured as we go forward.
Well, I'd love to know, as you look at, you know, your partners who want to do more work and take on more work, are these partners around the same age, younger, older? Help describe kind of the situation and how you would compare kind of your financial situation versus kind of some of your partners around you.
Sure. I'm going to be a little careful as to how much I say, but I would say that career-wise, I have the second longest career of the group, and I know
young group.
Yep, we're a young group, and there's definitely student loan debt out there, and you know, I think they're still tackling that, like we talked about quite a bit already. It's a big burden, so and there are other expenses that, you know, to each individual person that they might have that I might not. So yeah, and by only working 10% more, I don't know how much they'll really notice. It'll be more noticeable for me because I'm the one person making a major change, whereas they're maybe picking up a shift or two each month. I'm going to drop almost half of mine.
Isn't that something? Well, I think as you look at lifestyle choices, you know, it's one of those things that really, I believe, can determine when you retire, whether it's the car that you drive or the house that you buy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, where I am, a lot of the physicians choose to live on the lake, or one of many lakes, and I love living on the lake, too. You know, my parents live on a lake, too. But when we moved here, we decided that we were going to pay with cash, so we looked at houses that were in our range. We found one on a river really close to the hospital, and that worked out well. But I certainly know other physicians who have spent double, triple, or more than we did on a home, and we love our home, you know. But yeah, the car thing, yeah, big, you know, it's the big things. One house, one spouse, you know.
Yes.
Because you can really lose a lot of money on those particular choices that you make.
So cars and houses and divorce, I mean, huge differentiators. And you're now at this point where you're going to be able to retire from clinical medicine in the next couple of years. Would you say you've made some mistakes along the way? Or has this just been pretty flawless as you've gone about?
I'm perfect, of course. yeah, no, I definitely definitely went with a really nice, really big house when we took our first full-time job, which we didn't do until after we'd worked locums for a couple of years. So I'd saved up enough to buy a nice waterfront lot and knew the community pretty well and had worked the job as a locum for about 4 or 5 months before deciding to come back full time eventually. So we built a really nice big 4,000 square foot custom home with granite everywhere, and it was everything we wanted, and it was going to be our forever home. And, you know, naive as we were at the time, we went all out. And in hindsight, that wasn't such a good idea because the hospital that I took a job at ended up going bankrupt and shutting its doors down for a period of time. And I had been let go a little before that as they were entering the downward spiral. So I got a good about 3 or 4 years there, and then it was time to move on. And we had built really pretty much the nicest home in town, and it was really it was overbuilt for the neighborhood it was in, and once there was no hospital, there were very few people who could afford a house like that in a town of about 5,000 where there weren't many good jobs or many jobs at all.
Wow.
So we hung on to it as a rental and then a seasonal rental, and you know, at first we were wondering if there was a way to get back there, but it just didn't work out. So we ended up selling it at a loss. By the time you count for realtor's fees, about $250,000 less than what we put into it. So that was a big mistake. I was able to take some of that as a loss on our taxes since we were using it as a rental, but still, that definitely set us back quite a bit.
And look at you now. I mean, I think you look at that story, and that really speaks to that you can recover from this stuff. And I'm sure that was a early lesson to you
It was, and then that kept us from doing the same thing again when we moved to where we are now. You know, I still had that mortgage, and that's why I said, I don't want another big mortgage. You know, let's buy a house that that we can sell some funds in our taxable account and just cover the cost. And we still got a great home, but yeah, we spent less than half actually on our current home than we did building the first one. And if I hadn't had that mistake, I probably would have bought, you know, who knows, maybe an $800,000 home, $1 million home, and just figured, well, I earn enough to afford the payments, you know, and that's a trap that a lot of people fall into. You know, if you can afford the payments, you can have it. And technically, yes, you can, but then you're locked into maybe it's a 30-year mortgage of making those payments.
Well, and the bank will gladly lend you the money,
right?
for forever. And I think about earlier in our interview about how you looked at being debt free, I have to imagine that experience of knowing that the job market can change on you suddenly might have shaped that decision. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, whenever I tell people about, you know, the bankrupt hospital, they say, "Well, that never happens." I'm like, well, no, not normally, but it happened to me and it can happen again. And yeah, you just never know.
So do you think like that shaved off a year of retirement for you guys? You know, that kind of decision, how would you describe monetarily the impact of that?
Yeah, the impact, I guess after the tax deduction from taking a loss on some of it, you know, probably set us back $200,000, which, you know, I've got a really good job and we don't spend a ton of money. So that's probably about a year's worth of what we save after we cover, you know, our living expenses. So yeah, that probably added a year.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's a good way to look at it. And I also look at, you know, I like to be fully transparent. So when I tell my story, and I've mentioned it several times, I did have some help from family, right? My dad also helped me get started with an IRA when I was like 18. And so I try to quantify that in terms of, well, how much of an advantage did that actually give me? And I'm very grateful for the help that I've gotten. But when I think about, well, the $40,000 in school money, maybe, you know, another $10,000 in the IRA money that my parents kind of helped fund, that's $50,000 then, maybe it's $100,000 now. That's probably 6 months that head start that it gave me in terms of reaching financial independence. So if someone's thinking, well, yeah, he was able to do that because his parents gave him all this money and his grandpa was a doctor and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, truthfully, it got me here 6 months quicker. So maybe I would have been 40 years and 3 months instead of 39 years and 9 months old when I hit FI. So having those benefits certainly helped, made it easier, but they aren't necessarily required to reach financial independence at an early age.
Well, I think the big thing that I would encourage everyone to think about is those living expenses, right? I mean, to me, that is the biggest determinant of when you can step away.
Yeah, and we didn't really keep close track ever. I knew what our credit card payments were, and that's where most of our spending was recorded. And so I kind of knew that we were financially independent when I really looked at all of our assets and made a guesstimate as to our annual spending. But once I started blogging, I actually decided to keep track and use Mint.com to help track all the credit card expenses and categorize things. And, you know, in the first year that we tracked, we spent a little over $70,000, and the first full 12 months, it was actually about $62,000 a year. And again, now that we're financially independent, we have fewer expenses than we did before. So I no longer carry disability insurance. Very glad that I did when I was younger and didn't have this nest egg. I no longer carry term life for the same reason. And again, no mortgage. So last year, and that's another blog post that breaks everything down, we spent $62,000 as a family of four, and our biggest expenses were food and travel. So you take out the mortgage, you take out some of those expensive insurance payments, and you can do a lot on what a lot of people would consider a pretty small budget, you know, relatively, you know, for physicians.
Well, you know, I think about that. I think about the word financial independence, and I think about the word retirement. And those can all be really different things. And I kind of tease around this idea in some of my various things across the web of retiring by 45 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think, in my opinion, kind of that traditional retirement is dead for someone that is under 55, because so much stuff can change. And I'd like to know from your perspective, like, you're going to be retiring from clinical medicine, but I would argue you're not in fact, like, truly, like, really retiring, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, there's a sort of a joke. I think it was, well, maybe not a joke, but a post by Mr. Money Mustache started it. He talked about the internet retirement police, saying you're not really retired. And we've actually got a company coming in for the next few days who are. He's a blogger, Mr. 1500, and he's going to be spending a few days with us here in northern Minnesota. And he says he hates the word retirement. You know, he left a high-paying job in computers, software, something or other. But he still does, you know, meaningful work. He's doing things that are sort of his pet projects, and he'll still make money from his blog and different things. So yeah, I like to say retired from clinical medicine is what I'm planning to do, but I'm sure I'll still be writing. I may have a whole different encore career that will have very little to do with making the most money, because that's the whole point of financial independence, is that you've got the money you need to live the lifestyle you want. Anything else is pretty much superfluous. Yeah. So I don't know exactly what life will look like. I love the fact that I can do this while I still have kids at home and still have another good probably 10 years until we have that empty nest from the time I retire, if we retire within the next couple of years. So we'll be doing a lot as a family. We'll be doing a lot of travel. I'll still probably be writing. There could be other projects that I have not even thought about yet.
Well, thank you for being so transparent about that, because I think in today's world, you know, people get enamored with this word passive income. And I'm getting more and more thumping the table on that it is active income.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, like real estate is probably the biggest one that you read about as passive income. But, you know, unless you're just buying a fund and collecting checks, it's not passive. If you're researching the deals and maybe you're even the one that's managing the property and calling the people to fix the toilet or fixing it yourself, that's very active. I mean, the most passive income out there is, of course, investing in mutual funds and ETFs that simply give you a little bit of money back. You know, it's not nearly as much money as people might hope for with passive income. You know, blogging is another one that's talked about as passive income, but if you're putting in 20, 30 hours a week, which I probably do between all the writing and, you know, participating in different forums and writing my own posts and replying to comments and all those things, it's a lot of time and it's not passive. Now, if I were to quit doing it and there might still be some residual income, I might have built something that would continue to provide some passive income, but it was very active, you know, in the time that I had been doing it. And I don't anticipate quitting anytime soon, but I'm just saying, talking with bloggers that have been around a lot longer than I have, because I just started mine January of last year, you know, there is potential for passive income once you've built it up very actively.
Well, I think, to me, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, with blogging or podcasting, such as we're doing today, right. I think it becomes more passive, obviously, the more money you make if you can hire people. Is if you look at Jim Dolly, you know, obviously he started out himself and now he has kind of a team of people around him, and you're part of the network of people associated with him, whether it's guest posts or whatever. I'm sure he puts a lot of time into it, but perhaps the team takes a good load of that off of him, so it can be more passive.
That's true. Yep, and his time is very valuable, whether he's doing the blog or working as an ER emergency medicine physician. You know, he only has so much of it. He's got four kids too, and you know, a great family. So, yeah, every hour of his that he can you know, offload that work to someone else, it does help make that income a bit more passive. And you know, I know he's also partnered with you know, people that he knows and cares about. So he's helping those people out that are working for him that are probably making more money than they were before, and also, like you say, taking some of that burden off his shoulders. I haven't hired anybody really to do any work other than a little bit through Upwork.com just to look at my site speed and security and that sort of thing. But that was minimal, one-time job kind of deal. And yeah, I have his, we share a business manager now, the White Coat Investor and I, so I have been able to take away some of that finding the advertisers and setting up some of those deals, because it did become a bit cumbersome as I just wanted to sit down and write, but then I'd have 2 hours of emails and inserting the different ad widgets and whatnot. So it is nice to have some of that taken off my hands, and yeah, there is.
Well, I would love to transition as we close out this conversation in the next 10 minutes or so.
Sure.
You alluded to this earlier of having this charitable mission. So tell us more about that. What is going on with the charitable mission in your blog?
Yeah. So I started this website from a standpoint of already having attained financial independence by virtue of having at least 25 times our anticipated retirement expenses. So right off the bat, I'm saying, I don't need any more money. That's my message, right? So then when ads start popping up and links to Amazon and different things, people are going to think, oh, geez, what a dirtbag, right? I mean, he's telling us he doesn't need the money, and then here's a money grab, you know, all over the sidebar and everywhere else. So to help justify that, I decided from day one that I was going to donate half of my profits from the site. And I think if it becomes really popular, then I can do a whole lot of good. But already I'm seeing, you know, even half my profits now this year will be, and actually last year was pretty close, but this year definitely will be a four-figure number. And I'd love to see that grow. And you know, I'll be reporting on what I do with that money and where it goes and how we're helping people. So, yeah, I think it's a really, really great thing. And I love the fact that people are, you know, choosing to use my links occasionally for, you know, whether it's to start their own blog or refinance student loans, or just patronize any of the people that are advertising with me. That does help grow the income, which will help me grow that charitable mission. And one way that I have been donating the money is through a donor advised fund, which I have written a number of posts about, because I think it's a great way for particularly people with high income to donate now in advance of actually giving the money out later. So the way the donor advised fund works is you can donate to a fund that you control, but you only control it by virtue of you can send the money out to various charities. Once you've given it away, you can't take it back. So I have money with Vanguard Charitable and with Fidelity Charitable. And you know, every fall or whenever a reason arises, I'll go in, log in, and send money out to a charity via that donor advised fund. But you get to take the tax deduction in the year that you donate to the fund. So for example, this being my last year of basically full-time income, I'm going to do my last big push donating money in there. And I had set a goal of $250,000 in donor advised funds before retiring. So by the end of the year, I'll make sure that that's all there. Because in future years, when I'm in a much lower marginal tax bracket, donating money won't be as rewarding, as far as, you know, for every dollar I donate, it might only be like $1.25 because I'm in a lower tax bracket. Whereas right now, if I donate a dollar, I get 40 some cents back. Or if I donate $1.68 or $1.70, actually cost me a dollar because of that tax break. So I want to take full advantage of that while I can, which allows me to basically donate the most or get the most for my donated dollars. That was a long-winded answer, but I really do think the donor advised fund is a great thing for any physician to do, whether you have a blog or a charitable mission or not. Donate now in the anticipation of giving later. And I do give from the fund. And we give, like, you know, but I'm going to treat it kind of like our nest egg, maybe give 4%, 5%, 6% each year from the fund and more as I grow older and realize that there's going to be money left over.
Well, just to run people through the choices real quick and maybe talk this very, very, very quickly through. There's different entities you can set up, like a charitable remainder trust or a charitable lead trust or a foundation. Some of these things give you tax deductions right off the front. Others don't. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, you get the deduction up front, but you don't control the money legally in the donor advice fund, but you also don't have to file all of the tax forms.
Right. It's a lot easier to maintain, and it has lower fees. The big ones, Fidelity, Vanguard, Schwab, they all have fees that run 0.6% per year, plus the expense ratio of the funds you invest in, which are a fairly broad range of index funds typically. And so, yeah, the fees are very reasonable. And actually, it's very similar to the tax drag I would see on my money if I just left it in a taxable account. Yep. So I don't know as much about some of the others, but like when I looked at foundation and some of those, I saw a lot of fees and a lot of, like you said, paperwork, whereas this is really simple and it actually makes donating money easier rather than more difficult because you just do it online. It's like super quick.
Let me just say there's a reason Bill Gates established a foundation. And most of us don't have those kinds of resources.
Right. When you're looking at tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands, you maybe don't need your own foundation with a board of directors, but when you're looking at tens of millions or billions, that's a whole different ball game.
And so as we wrap up the interview here, my friend, I would just love for you to sit back for a moment and ponder the past, that you're not a practicing physician anymore. You're a resident. If you could sit down with a younger POF, a younger physician on fire, a first-year resident, just mashed out of medical school, what would you tell him?
I would tell him he should look for a website like mine or the White Coat Investors and maybe read a couple good books. And there are a whole bunch out there, and I have some recommendations on my site. Specific information, I would say be wary of building that big house. And I know that older physicians told me the same thing, and I didn't listen to them. I also had an attending who said three times, he said, "Rent, don't buy. Rent, don't buy. Rent." And he said, you know, for your first job, because about half of all doctors leave their first job within a few years. And, you know, of course, that's another one that I didn't listen to because I knew it all. But yeah, there's just so much more information that's out there now than there was even 10 years ago when I was, or 15 years ago when I was a resident. And you need to take the time to actually read it. You know, for every 10 hours you spend on yourself doing something fun, spend 1 hour reading a website or a book, and you'll be well worth your time.
All righty. Well, you're ready for a quick lightning round before we wrap this thing up?
Sure.
All right, Physician on Fire, what is your guilty pleasure?
I'm going to have to say craft beer. I don't like to spend tons of money on, some kind of, you know, liquid, but I have been known to buy an occasional $20 bottle of good craft beer.
Best book you've ever read?
I like The Millionaire Next Door. You know, that really kind of defined how I should approach wealth and what wealth really looks like.
And the duty that you want to have your kids take on for you that you don't want to do anymore?
I guess I would say washing the dishes, but I don't do much of that anyway. Let me think. I'll let them mow the lawn. I enjoy it, but it'll be a good thing for them to learn. I learned when I was a little bit older than they were.
Perfect. All right, my friend. Well, it has been great to have you on. You know, I just want to say what I appreciate about you is you really come with this brand of humor I talked about earlier. You make the financial education piece interesting and fun, and hopefully a little bit of that came through in the interview. We talked about a lot of your journey, but I just want to encourage you, keep doing what you're doing. Thank you for doing it. And any other parting words for our listeners?
Come check out the site if you haven't, physicianonfire.com, and I would love to hear your comments. And thank you very much, David, for chatting with me. I had a great time talking to you. Hope,
all right, man.
Meet you in person here one of these times. Like you said, we're not that far apart, so might have to meet up sometime after I go to a football game or something down there.
There we go. We'll do it. I don't drink beer, but I'll be happy to treat you to one.
Right on.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much for being with us. And if people have more questions, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
You can find me on the website, I don't think you need that, just physicianonfire.com. I'm on Twitter with the @ physicianonfire, and my email is pof@physicianonfire.com.
And my friends, that wraps it up for today. And in the next podcast, I would love to tell your story. Connect with me, and let's help tons of physicians together. So just make sure to contact me, Dave, at drfreedompodcast.com or on my website, www.drfreedompodcast.com. Now, anyhow, thank you so much for joining me. It means so much for me to take precious time, for you to take precious time out of your busy and compressed schedule. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Also, if you gain some value out of this podcast, my friend, and you are just loving this stuff, here's what I want you to do. I want you to grab your friend or your colleagues, their iPhone, their iPad, their Android device, whatever they got. I want you to find the podcast link on their device, get them subscribed to this podcast, and download your favorite episodes. And then tell them, hey, if they're ticked at you, they're going to thank you later, and you can just blame it all on me if they don't. So anyhow, thank you so much for joining me. It means so much to have you take time out of your busy, out of your compressed schedule. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. And remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.